So how many of the following things do you know to be true? The North Star is the brightest star in the nighttime sky. The sun is a yellow star. What goes up must come down. On a dark night, you can see millions of stars with the unaided eye. In space, there is no gravity. A compass points north. Days get shorter in the winter and longer in the summer, and total solar eclipses are rare. Well, if your answer to that question was any sum greater than zero, you are about to get a reality check from an astrophysicist. Maybe you know Neil deGrasse Tyson as director of the Hayden Planetarium at the Museum of Natural History, or from his column in Natural History magazine, or his books, or as the host of Nova Science Now on PBS, or from the Time People magazine declared him the sexiest astrophysicist alive. Dr. Tyson, so nice to have you back on WNYC.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
And I want to open up our phones right away for anything, folks, that you've always wanted to ask an astrophysicist about but didn't have one handy. Now you do. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or email brianlehrershow@wnyc.org. And meanwhile, compasses don't point north?
Oh, of course not. They never did, actually. they point towards the geomagnetic north of Earth, which is not even a fixed point. It's kind of migrates under the tundras of Canada. And so
what's the difference between north and geomagnetic north?
Oh, well, they're not in the same place. North, the north everyone knows and loves is where Santa Claus lives, the North Pole. That's the
magical north.
Yeah, that North Pole is where the axis of Earth's rotation emerges, and that's north. You'd want to know that that's north. Anything else is an approximation of north. But this is not a new discovery. This is well known. The compass is just, it's better than not knowing anything. But there are much better ways, particularly today with GPS. You know, who needs a compass anyway?
And the North Star is not the brightest star in the nighttime sky?
Oh, no. I did the experiment. I stopped people on the street and asked them, what's the brightest star in the night sky? 9 out of 10 said the North Star. And I almost cried because it means they've never looked up. The North Star is not even in the top 10 or the top 20 or the top 30 or the top 40. It's like the 49th brightest star of the night sky. It's kind of uninteresting, really, compared with many other stars, Sirius and Procyon and Canopus. And
so what did we used to hear about sailors navigating by the North Star and all of that?
Oh, it's not invisible, but it's has this nice juxtaposition near Earth's the projection of Earth's North Pole on the sky. So once again, if you didn't have any other way of finding North, you'd find the North Star and the Big Dipper, and you'd triangulate on that.
And these are all taken from a chapter in your book called Things People Say, like the sun is a yellow star. The sun is not a yellow star.
No, it's white. It's just plain old white. And if you take a yellow light and shine it on something that's white, what's
white yellow?
It turns yellow. That's what happens. And when you look at snow illuminated by sunlight, the snow is not yellow. Except near fire hydrants, of course.
Yeah, that yellow sun. So you also give us, though, the depressing news that our sun will eventually burn itself up, making life on Earth as we know it impossible. How long do we have, Doc?
Oh, there's far more depressing news available than that, because that won't happen for about another 5 billion years. And I can't wait for my first PDA to have a year that far in advance. I'm going to put it on the calendar, start looking for the sun to die.
Yes.
But the sun, it will, all of our understanding of the evolution of stars tells us that the sun will run out of its fuel, it will expand, become so large that it will engulf the entire orbits of Mercury, Venus, and Earth, so that Earth will be orbiting within the sun's gaseous high-temperature surface, and we'd be this ember, long-lost planet, devoid of life.
So all this effort to prevent mankind from destroying ourselves is for naught?
Well, like I said, there are other more pressing issues like asteroids and viruses and the things that you should put higher up on your list than worrying about the death of the sun.
Wait a minute. We have an asteroid question, I think, so
oh,
let's
sure.
get right to it. Gary in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Dr. Tyson. Hi, Gary.
Yes, hi. Actually, it might have been a comet. I'm not sure. I could have the names wrong, but I think it was Hale-Bopp that struck Jupiter many years ago. And when it did, it was said to have struck at a certain longitude and latitude. And I've always wondered ever since, how did they determine longitude on a body that has no fixed features?
Not to be confused with Hale Boggs, who I think was Cokie Roberts' father, but go ahead.
Okay, Comet Hale-Bopp, which is an odd name to have for a comet, was a comet from the 1990s that was not the comet that you're referring to. The one you're referring – by the way, Hale-Bopp, just to put that back on the books, was the brightest, longest visible comet ever in the history books. So that happened in our lifetimes and our generation. So many people did not take that fact lightly. They were out looking at it every night. And in fact, I saw it from Times Square. I'd never seen a comet from the middle of Manhattan before I saw Hale-Bopp. The comet you refer to is Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9,
okay,
which is a testament to how many times Shoemaker and Levy have looked for comets. That's the ninth one in that comet pair discovery team. That comet did hit Jupiter. It hit the southern hemisphere. You can easily get a latitude, which you clearly know and understand from your question. The question is, what about the longitude? And you're right. You can't fix a longitude when you don't have a fixed surface on which to place it. So
why do we want to know this? Why does it matter?
Well, what people sometimes like to do is say, well, what would that longitude and latitude be on Earth, and get the corresponding spot, and then wonder if that hit Earth, what damage would it do? By the way, the comet that hit Jupiter, which we should view that as a shot across our bow, all right? Collisions have happened in the past. There's one that took out the dinosaurs here on Earth. They will again happen in the future. So this is not some science fiction story. It is real. And that was a comet that broke into two dozen pieces from the stresses of Jupiter's gravity. And each piece plunged into Jupiter's atmosphere one after another, and Jupiter rotates relatively quickly. And so each next piece that hit created a new scar zone different from the first piece that hit in advance of it. And so Jupiter had this string of pockmarks around in its southern hemisphere, visible even from a backyard amateur telescope. So I think the real concern here is not how we determine the longitude, but whether this will happen to Earth.
Gary, thank you for your call. Right. My guest, Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson on WNYC. His latest book is Death by Black Hole and Other Cosmic Quandaries, a collection of his essays from recent years. You know, my favorite one actually from that list of myths that you had in that one chapter is there is no gravity in space. There is gravity.
Oh, of course. Space? Yeah, if there's no – people say, oh, look at the astronauts in orbit. There's no gravity there. Look, there was no gravity in orbit. What's holding the moon to Earth? Moon orbits the Earth. Moon feels Earth's gravity. So surely the astronauts do as well.
But we always hear when the astronauts go up that they are then in a weightless state.
Oh, yeah. They're weightless, but that doesn't mean there's no gravity. In fact, they're falling to Earth. You would, if you were on an elevator shaft and I cut the cable, you would fall to Earth. The elevator would fall. You would fall. The contents in your pockets would fall. Everything would fall at exactly the same rate, and therefore you're weightless when that happens.
So weight is not a function of gravity.
No, wait. If you're standing on a surface, then you'll have weight. That's right. If you're in free fall, which you're almost always doing on journeying to the moon or to Mars, then you are under the influence of a gravity moving by that action, and everything moves together. Here's a quick experiment to do. Take a paper cup, a tall one, one of these big gulp cups, and fill it with water and puncture a hole in the bottom of it. And, of course, the water will spigot out of it, right? Take that same cup while the water is spigoting out of it, and then drop it. The water will stop coming out of the hole while it's airborne.
Why?
Because the water is weightless. It doesn't know. Oh. It doesn't feel the pressure of the water
really?
Above it. And the water will stop coming out until you re-catch it in your hand or until it spills on the ground.
But do it over the sink.
Over the sink, yes.
Now, you explode all these myths in the section of your book called Science and Culture, the ruffled interface between cosmic discovery and people's reaction to it. Are you suggesting that people are slow to accept fact as fact, or that culture somehow works against science?
Oh, culture definitely works against science. If culture were not in conflict with science, then science as we now practice it would have been invented thousands of years ago. It would have been a very natural consequence of just people living their lives. But it's not. The idea that you want to trust your eyes, trust your thoughts, trust your memory, these are bad things for science. What we learned over the centuries is that the human machine is one of the worst data-taking apparatuses you could ever come up with. And that's why we go out of our way to build a black box. We go out of our way to get the chart recorder, to get the film, to get the data. And so once you do that, you discover things about the universe that fall outside of your common sense, that the universe is expanding, that black holes you fall in, you don't come out ever, that you particles can disappear and reappear somewhere else. These are things about the universe you can't trust your senses anymore. So no longer can you pass judgment on a scientific idea and say, that does not make sense. Of course it doesn't make sense. We're discovering it by tools that go beyond the five senses of the human body.
Loki in Queens. You're on WNYC with Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson. Hello. Do we have Loki there?
Yes, hello. Dr. Tyson.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air, Loki. Hey.
Sorry. Dr. Tyson, I wanted to ask you, I saw in a TV documentary that we're living in a multiverse as opposed to a universe. Parallel universe is an infinite number. How can you explain that to me in terms of reincarnation? In other words, we die in one and we are born in another parallel universe at almost simultaneous time.
Whoa, we just jumped from the concept of a multiverse to the concept of reincarnation there. First, what about the multiverse?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, there's strong theoretical arguments for why there would be a multiverse, and there are also philosophical arguments.
What is a multi? I mean, if you know, the concept of the universe is that there is, you know, all of existence is encompassed in the universe. Mm-hmm. So even if there are multi somethings, wouldn't they be all part of ultimately a universe, which is everything?
You might call that a metaverse at that point.
Okay.
Yeah, so just when you consider the day when we thought Earth was kind of special and alone and unique, we tend to be one of many planets. And then, oh, the sun is surely special. Nope, it's one of 100 billion suns. Oh, but the Milky Way galaxy, that's the whole. No, it's one of 50 or 100 billion galaxies. Well, surely our universe is there. And so here you have this trend line. It's a trend line of ego-shattering concepts that we're not alone, we're not special, we're not unique. And the next natural place to put that is to ask, are we the only universe or are there many? That's the philosophical argument. But there's cogent theoretical arguments for why there might be a multiverse that come out of the intersection of quantum mechanics and general relativity, the theory of gravity that explains the Big Bang. And so, but what it would mean is there'd be other places where the laws of physics might be a little different. If that's the case, you have fully justified to call that another universe. Yeah. You don't want to visit that universe.
Where our laws of physics don't apply.
Where your laws of physics that hold your atoms together, no telling what'll happen there. That's where you want to send the robot.
Well, he goes from there to reincarnation, do you?
Well, the idea is if you want to take this to metaphysical extremes and just, you know, sit down with a beer and a lounge chair and have this conversation, be my guest, but don't call it science. What you'll have is some infinite number of universes where all possible outcomes are unfolding in these universes. There's an infinite universe. There's one where you and I are having this conversation, but perhaps in another language, or our roles are swapped, or whatever, and ones that are slightly different. Or maybe there's one that's exactly the same. And so if it's the same and it's time shifted, you might imagine that you exist in some other universe. But is it the same you, or is it just some replica of you? And so it's an interesting conversation, but it's not anchored in anything real.
In fact, you have a few essays in the book about science and religion, and you make the definitive statement that, quote, as currently practiced, there is no common ground between science and religion.
Yeah, it's basically true. That's
none
right.
At all?
None. There's just none. If there were, I can tell you what would happen. What would happen is the scientists would have a shelf of religious text. And they say, oh, here's a conundrum in the cosmos. I don't quite understand what happens here. And they would comb the religious text to see if they'd find an answer to that question. Then they publish that answer. And they say, we did the computer simulation, we checked the Bible, we checked the Quran, and here's the answer. Anytime people have tried to predict something about the physical universe by their readings of religious scripture, it's just been false. It's just been wrong. It's been wrong every single time to predict something that was previously unknown. People go back and account for what is already known by reinterpreting phrases and passages.
You call those post-dictions.
Post-dictions, right. A post-diction, you know, it's kind of like a Rudyard Kipling just-so story. This is how the leopard got its spots. You already know the leopard has its spots. Now invent an explanation, and then you go on to the next question. What you want to do is check the predictability of an idea, and that's where the rubber hits the road.
Does science predict things, or does it explain things?
It does both. What you do is you explain things, and that same account give you a prediction, so now you can advance our understanding of the universe. If you have an idea that doesn't advance our understanding, take up another subject, but you can't call it science. And, oh, yes, simple things you take for granted. You look in the newspaper what time the sun is going to rise, when the next eclipse is going to happen, when the next asteroid is going to have a close approach. These are all predictions, and we know it enough that we're on to the next set of problems. There's no longer any uncertainty in whole swaths of our understanding of the universe.
We'll continue in a minute with Neil deGrasse Tyson, astrophysicist, Hayden Planetarium director, PBS host, author, with anything you've always wanted to ask an astrophysicist about, but didn't have one around the house. 212-433-WNYC. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson. His latest book is Death by Black Hole and Other Cosmic Quandaries. He is also perhaps known to you as director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History, or the host of Nova Science Now on PBS. And that's not the same as the series Nova. This is a separate series, right?
You can think of it as a spinoff, actually. Nova is still there for all the Nova lovers out there. Nova's been around for decades, actually. But what we found is that there's a niche, there's a marketplace of people for whom an entire hour of a single science subject might be more than their attention span will allow, but they definitely want more than the soundbite they'd get on the evening news. And so Nova Science Now is kind of modeled like CBS's 60 Minutes. There are segments, there are science segments, multiple segments within the hour. In the end, I offer something called a cosmic perspective to tie a bow on all that you had learned. I remembered when watching 60 Minutes, if Andy Rooney wasn't on at the end, I felt like my evening was incomplete. So I wanted to make sure.
You have that role.
I've got that role now. That's right.
Is that when you talk about space elevators on next week's show?
No. The space elevators is actually a whole segment. The cosmic perspective is really so that to further deepen our collective understanding of our place in the universe.
So you go like, do you ever wonder whether the moon was really made of green cheese, that kind of thing? What is a space elevator, by the way?
Oh, yeah. So one of the segments Tuesday night is on the space elevator, which is this kind of dreamy, futuristic way to get into space. And how do you do it? You put a platform 22,000 miles above Earth's surface. That's at what we call geosynchronous orbit. That's where all of our communication satellites are. They will complete one full orbit around Earth in the same time it takes Earth to rotate. So it looks like they hover above any particular spot. So you put a platform up there and then lower down a hose or a rope or a ribbon and lower it all the way down to Earth, and then you climb up this rope to get to orbit. There's no chemical fuels. There's no rockets. There's no launch pads. And it's imagined to be a much cheaper way to get into space.
Interesting. Dallas in Manhattan wants to challenge one of your interpretations of the things on your myths list that we started
out with. Oh, sure. Go for
Dallas,
it.
Dallas, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Yeah, I just want to say that the myth that they mentioned before was about not see, or the myth that you do see millions of stars in the night sky. And it's interesting to me because I grew up in Manhattan, so I grew up in this thing because, like, you know, four stars. But then I had an opportunity to be out in the middle of the ocean, away from every landmass and a darkened ship. And I got to tell you, those stars from one horizon to the other, you could even see that pale strip of the Milky Way going across. It was just all stars.
But did you count them?
I tried.
Okay.
I tried.
Is the key word here millions?
There's no secret in the language there. First, I had read this statistic that there's only a couple thousand stars you can see, and so I tested it. I went to a mountaintop at 8,000 feet, which is better than what you'd get in the countryside or even at the ocean. And I counted stars in a sector of the sky, found out how many sectors there were all around the sky, multiplied it out, I got 2,500 stars. So it feels like millions, particularly if you come from the city. Anything bigger than four is going to look like millions. But really, it's only a couple of thousand stars in the night sky.
Dallas, thanks for your call. Now, some of the chapter titles of your book pose the ultimate questions. You have titles like The Nature of Knowledge and The Meaning of Life. Can astrophysics teach us the meaning of life?
Well, that's an interesting question. We can, so often in the past, meaning issues forth from a deeper and deeper understanding of a phenomenon. So I don't think we can pretend to understand the meaning of anything unless we fully understand everything that idea, concept, or phenomenon has to offer. So what the methods and tools of science are providing us are ways to understand how life works. Is life out there? Are we unique? Are we alone? And from this, you can begin to take on a dialogue of meaning. For example, it's kind of interesting to know that 40% of the DNA of a yeast is in common with what we have in human beings. That's kind of interesting to know. If you want to draw meaning, if one of your meanings is we are special and nothing else is, that's the wrong meaning to get from this information. So the investigation of the universe does indeed inform conversations about meaning.
Information contributes to the development of meaning. I guess it gets back to the science and religion discussion a little bit, though, because one could argue that, yeah, leave the facts of the universe to science, but leave the interpretation of what it means ethically or morally or in terms of our sense of identity more to religion or or philosophy or those kinds of pursuits.
I don't have a fundamental problem with that, but I can tell you that modern definitions of whether you're alive while you're there on life support on the bed is whether you're, you know, your brainwaves, whether you're flatlined. And this is not something you divine from having someone breathe into a mirror as they did hundreds of years ago. This is you're applying methods and tools to inform people who would then make the decision about whether you're going to maintain life support or not. So at all places in the discussions of ethics or morals, you can't conduct that without having the full information available to you.
Chris in Pleasantville, you're on WNYC with Neil deGrasse Tyson. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how are you?
All right.
I had a question about whether or not it's theoretically possible to go faster in space the farther away you get from the source of gravity, the sun.
Well, if you get big enough rockets, you know, it's just a matter of how much fuel you're carrying. You can accelerate yourself right on up to just a little bit less than the speed of light, but you can't reach the speed of light according to all known laws of physics. But you can. There's nothing in principle stopping you. It's an engineering problem. It's not a physics problem. Well, and in fact, as long as physics doesn't prevent it, we can dream about it in our science fiction stories or as reality.
Well, I think that's my question, though. Is on the cellular level, most of your cells are made up of, or the molecules are made up of void, right? And it's magnetism. So my question would be, would the laws of physics, Einstein's physics, would they change possibly if you got far enough away from the sun?
Oh, no, the sun has nothing special about its gravity compared with Earth's gravity or anybody else's gravity. No. There are conditions that slow down your metabolic rate when you're in the presence of a very high source of gravity. The sun operates a little bit that way, but you would have other concerns getting close enough to the sun to measure this phenomenon, like getting vaporized. But these are things that would happen if you descended into a black hole. There's a whole chapter in Death by Black Hole on what would happen to you as you descend to a black hole. But again, other things will take effect. You'll get ripped apart. You'll bifurcate into pieces. You'll get extruded through the fabric of space-time. And you're not going to be worrying about, you know, the voids in your atoms. You've got other concerns at that point. So, no, the gravity is not something special that's somehow creating an environment that wouldn't otherwise be there even outside of the gravity.
Thanks for your call, Chris. This is 93.9 and AM 820 WNYC and WNYC.org. We continue with Neil deGrasse Tyson, director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History, host of Nova Science Now on PBS, and the author of his latest book, Death by Black Hole and Other Cosmic Quandaries, published by Norton, and giving you the opportunity to ask anything you always wanted to know from an astrophysicist but never had one around the house. Our lines are full, but our inbox is always open. Brian Lehrer Show at WNYC.org. And here's an email that asks, I recall hearing something about the speed of light being exceeded by some Japanese scientist, something moving in a copper wire. True?
There are things that can move faster than light, but it's not material objects and it's not information. So what happens is there's a headline that'll grab your attention regarding what ends up moving faster than the speed of light. But no one is transmitting information or physical objects faster than the speed of light. But if that day ever comes, first it would violate well-known laws of physics, but that's okay. It would bring in new understandings of the universe. And we would kind of need that if we want to travel through space across to the stars and across the galaxy, even at the speed of light. If you watch someone cross the galaxy, it would take them 100,000 years. You'd long dead before that happens. That's why in Star Trek they had warp drives that pinched the fabric of space, and you'd cut a hole through that pinched zone, and you'd basically cheat and cut across those vast distances by bridging. So you need clever ways to do that so you can cross the galaxy during the TV commercial.
So here's another email that asks, what would your dream space exploration mission be given no budget restrictions?
Oh, for me personally, I'd do two things. I'd go to Saturn and visit. It's my favorite planet. It's always,
why? Why Saturn?
It's gorgeous. Saturn.
You're into rings?
It's this sort of piece of majesty in the middle of the solar system. It's just gorgeous. Totally gorgeous. That's number one. Number two, I would then take a side trip to one of Jupiter's moons, Europa, which is ice-covered, but the stress of Jupiter's gravity and the surrounding moons have pumped heat into its interior and has liquefied that ice sheet beneath the ice coating. And we think there's a liquid ocean. It's been liquid for billions of years. I want to go ice fishing on Europa, look to see if there's life that'll swim up to the camera lens. Those two things I want to do in the near term.
This apparent discovery of water or suspicion of water on Mars, is this important with
respect
to life? There's
a gully. There's water seeping out of the side of a crater. Liquid water. You know, we always knew Mars once had liquid water. It's bone dry today, drier than the driest deserts on Earth. There's dried riverbeds and floodplains. Mars' surface is scarred by the action of water. Graced, if you will, by the action of water. We like water. And so where did the water go? The best evidence was that it became permafrost beneath the soils. Okay, well, then it's frozen. But now we've got evidence that it's seeping out, either through some heat source that's yet to be understood or discovered, or the pressure from the Martian regolith that presses down on it could liquefy it. The source is unknown, but there's a gully the length of a football field that appeared between 1999, when it was last photographed, and 2005. It's real. Makes all the more reason to go back. And if it's liquid, could it be teeming with bacteria? And anywhere you find liquid water on Earth, you've got life. If not fishes, certainly bacteria.
Talk about things to make us not feel special.
That's right.
By the way, some of the emails that are coming in are just to say how cool you are. I'm going to embarrass you with one of them, which says, I love Dr. Tyson. I've heard him speak on other programs, and I wish more people would recognize his achievements. What a stupendous role model for all of us. Move aside pro athletes and rappers and let the man go through.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. In this effort, I see it as really a duty. If I can bring the universe to the public and the opportunity is there, to then not do it would be disrespectful of the public and would not be true to how science gets done in America. It gets funded by tax dollars. So you're learning about things that you've paid for. You have the right to hear it in whatever is the best way we can conjure up to deliver it.
How many astrophysicists are there in the world?
There aren't that many. There's about 6,500. And if you do the math, there's about 6.5 billion total people. You divide those two numbers, it's about 1 in 1 million. So your earlier comments about if you have one you can ask a question of, you better do it, because you never know when the next time you're going to be hanging out with an astrophysicist will be.
So when people say you're 1 in 1 million, then you could say, yes, that is literally scientifically true, and really be a stick in the mud. Frank in Monmouth County, you're on WNYC.
Yes, hi. My question was, do more physicists believe in the Big Crunch or that the universe is just going to die off?
Oh, no, we're done there. We're past that.
What's the Big Crunch?
The Big Crunch, my preference would have been called the Big Squeeze. That would be, we know we're in an expanding universe. Is there enough gravity around to slow down that expansion and have us recollapse and end up back in the same spot in a reverse film of the Big Bang that got us to where we are to begin with? And people call it the Big Crunch, but I'd like to think of it as the Big Squeeze. All evidence, and especially recent evidence about the accelerating universe, points to the fact that we are on a one-way street, expansion to oblivion. And you just got to get over that. I'm sorry to have to bring that news to you. There's none of this, cycling universe, we're in one of many cycles. It's like, no. While that may be philosophically pleasing, of course, the universe could care less about our philosophies. It does what it wants.
So expansion is threatening to us. It is not just making more out there.
Well, because it's threatening to some, because it doesn't regenerate what we have created. In fact, all machines will wind down, all energy will asymptotically approach zero, and everything winds down. As T.S. Eliot said, the universe will end not with a bang, but with a whimper.
Being concerned with life at this level, then, does it affect your relationship to events in your own life or the world at large? Do wars and tsunamis and presidential elections seem more ephemeral to you than they might to the average person?
I would split that list, the brief list that you gave. I'd split the tsunamis from wars. The tsunamis are sort of natural events, and we want to look to science to try to solve those problems, perhaps avoid them or warn about them. We want to try to do something about that. So I celebrate what science has brought modern life, knowing that it has saved countless lives through medicine, through early warning systems, and all the ways that it does. The rest of what humans engage in, wars and the politics, and, you know, it's kind of depressing to look up and celebrate the vastness of the universe and then look back to Earth at the morning's news. You know, somebody gets killed in Baghdad, the leader gets hanged, the you know, more dead, more suffering, more hunger and genocide. And I think to myself, would people behave this way if they really understood our place in the universe? Our place is ephemeral. Our place is fragile. Our place, we're on this little speck we call Earth. When seen from space, as Carl Sagan made a big point of doing, we're this pale blue dot sitting in orbit around the sun. And that's humbling. And as far as I can judge, people who invade other countries are not humble people. They are people who feel large. And I think the more humble we all are, the more we'll get along with each other and the more we'll recognize that this Earth is all we've got, at least for now. So let's cherish it and each other.
I don't think we can top that. So we're going to leave it there.
Okay.
Neil deGrasse Tyson, T-Y-S-O-N. His latest book is Death by Black Hole and Other Cosmic Quandaries, published by Norton. His latest season of Nova Science Now begins next Tuesday night at 8 o'clock on Channel 13. He's director of the Hayden Planetarium, where when I was a kid, I went on school trips, and we all went, oh, wow. And then when I was a little older, I went with my friends to see the Pink Floyd music star shows and went, oh, wow. What's just on your way out the door? What's making them go, oh, wow, with the planetarium these days?
Well, in the old days, you would just show the night sky as viewed from Earth.
That was
now
enough.
We have projectors and data sets that take you anywhere you want in the universe. So it's not, oh, what constellation did you see? It's like, what stars in the constellation did you visit? And there's no parts of the universe off limits today at the modern Hayden Planetarium.
So great to have you here. Thanks a lot. Keep up the great work.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Mm-hmm.